Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 281. It's Monday, November 25th. I'm recording from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, a lot of stuff has happened since my last regular reporting. I had some family medical issues to deal with, so the last recorded show that I had was the day before the election, so a lot has changed since then, so let's get to it. I really want to start off, I guess, and do sort of a case study on RFK Jr. and his role as the nominee for the Department of Health and Human Services, a huge agency that covers like the FDA and NIH and CDC. And a bunch of other places. So let's get with it. Let's start with up first from the Hill. RFK Jr. role in Donald Trump administration sparks health concerns. Well, to say the least. President-elect Trump's promise to let RFK Jr. go wild on health is demoralizing public health experts who worry he could meddle with key government agencies, amplify vaccine hesitancy, and direct agency funding to favor his preferred views. Those views include removing fluoride from public water, promoting a wide variety of unorthodox and unproven treatments, and pushing a deep skepticism of pharmaceutical companies and the agencies overseeing them. FDA's war on public health is about to end, Kennedy wrote on social media shortly before the election, referring to the Food and Drug Administration. This includes its aggressive suppression of psychedelics, peptides, stem cells, raw milk, hyperbaric therapies, chelating compounds, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, vitamins, clean food, sunshine, exercise, nutraceuticals, and anything else that advances human health and can't be patented by pharma. If you work for the FDA and you're a part of this corrupt system, I have two messages for you. One, preserve your records, and two, pack your bags. I worry greatly for the future of public health, environment, and science in the next 4 years, says Lawrence Gostin, a global health law professor at Georgetown University Law Center. There's bipartisan interest in tackling chronic diseases, relying less on ultra-processed foods, and working to eliminate artificial trans fats. But there are doubts that Kennedy, who founded one of the most prominent anti-vaccine groups in the country, and has promoted the debunked claim that childhood vaccines cause autism, will limit his focus to nutrition. Let me put it this way. RFK Jr. doesn't have a track record of fidelity to science and evidence. Yes, we could work together across the aisle on ensuring that there wasn't excessive fat, trans fat, sodium in our food supply, but I'll believe it when I see it, Gostin said. Kennedy vowed to purge entire departments at the FDA to root out corruption. Attacking drug companies by completely overhauling the vaccine approval process would be a tall task, and the FDA won't force companies to pull vaccines off the market unless they present a real public safety concern. But Kennedy could still exert influence in other ways, such as appointing Trump loyalists and vaccine skeptics to a key vaccine advisory panel at the CDC. Those panel members are approved by the HHS secretary, who is picked by Trump, and make recommendations on vaccine policy. The recommendations aren't binding, but they help inform coverage decisions from insurers. A Kennedy-led Health and Human Services could also direct agency funding to anti-vaccine research or reduce funding for activities and research he disagrees with. Congress funds the agencies, but leaders have discretion on where to direct that money. That's the thing that I really worry about, that there's just going to be such a heavy, heavy choke on any funding that they're giving, or that it's going to be very, very targeted to only things he might agree with, said Scassia, Phillips Acue, an infectious disease epidemiologist and assistant professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Even if Kennedy himself isn't actively involved in making vaccine policy, his presence as a key insider can shape public perception, and he would have a bully pulpit to continue questioning vaccine science. I think the biggest risk of Kennedy is in his mouth, you know, creating distrust or confusion with the vaccine approval process, said Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association. Vaccines have been such a controversial area, and there's so many groups that he's worked with over the years that have spread misinformation. I suspect if he says something that's controversial, those groups will be poised to accelerate it and make it go viral. The federal government can't make vaccine requirements, only recommendations. It's up to states and local governments to implement them, Chrissy Giuliano, the executive director of the Big Cities Health Coalition, and saying that the federated system can add an extra layer of protection. The vast majority of public health authority sits at the state and local level, she said. I think during the first Trump administration, we saw a number of more progressive jurisdictions fill in the gaps, do the things they needed to do for their communities. Even with that extra layer, a CDC that's hostile to vaccines can have a significant impact, to say the least. Okay, next up from Stat News, RFK Jr. and Dr. Oz face tougher opposition on wellness than vaccines. While many critics of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Mehmet Oz are focused on their criticisms of vaccines, that focus is somewhat misplaced. The data supporting the safety and efficacy of recommended vaccines is far beyond dispute. But the reality is that the damage to getting Americans to vaccinate has already been done. The soon-to-be nominees for Health and Human Services Secretary and the leader of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services will be focused on another battle over wellness and prevention. There isn't a lot left for vaccine opponents to do. There are almost no serious state mandates for childhood vaccines. Parents who want to opt out are easily doing so, as can be seen by the resurgence in measles and whooping cough. Nearly 40% of teenagers are not up to date on the HPV vaccine, even as Australia and Scotland are on the verge of eliminating cervical cancer thanks to serious immunization campaigns. And huge numbers of adults are not getting vaccinated for COVID, flu, RSV, or shingles. The Biden administration totally confused the public about why in particular they needed boosters for COVID. Democrats avoided vaccination as an issue this election year because they knew that post-COVID, vaccinations become something of a political third rail. Could Kennedy and Oz make things worse? Absolutely. But are matters already bad? Sadly, yes. Where both Kennedy and Oz have traction is their focus on wellness and prevention. The emphasis on expensive cure and treatment in American healthcare is problematic, and the American people know it. This is why they disdain pharmaceutical companies for perpetuating treatments for enormous profits. What is far from clear is whether RFK Jr., Oz, and their Make America Healthy Again colleagues have any chance of taking on the current health system and swinging it toward prevention and wellness. What stands in their way? A lot. First, the man doing the appointing loves his cheeseburgers. A president who serves McDonald's at White House functions is not a man who may prove all that interested in a low-fat, low-sugar diet. Donald Trump Jr. recently posted a photo of Kennedy appearing ready to dig into some McDonald's with the president-elect. Sure, Trump said he wanted to let Kennedy, quote, run wild on health, but that may not last long when the runner arrives at his dinner table. Second, prevention comes with a bitter, divisive moral choice. Help those in need right now or benefit those not yet here. The fruits of prevention and wellness may not be seen for decades. The plight of those currently sick is right before our eyes. Those many tens of millions with cancer, ALS, muscular dystrophy, asthma, diabetes, Alzheimer's, cystic fibrosis, osteoarthritis, severe mental illnesses, heart disease, and so on will not be happy if Kennedy and Oz end up redirecting research funding and health insurance coverage toward wellness. When push comes to shove, the American people want money spent on rescuing those in need now more so than creating a healthier dotage. Third, wellness and prevention are rife with kooky nostrums, goop, and potions. Americans are already spending nearly $500 billion on wellness, according to McKinsey. How's that working out for us? Dr. Oz's love of blueberries may be sincere, but a lot of expensive wellness ideas don't work and cost a lot. Fundamentally, wellness and prevention are not as much fun as the freedom to live as you like. MAGA folks love their freedom. It is not for want for trying that doctors haven't made a dent in our lifestyles. More than 40% of us are obese, and the situation is worse in red states than in blue states. What is easier, giving up the fried chicken or taking a weekly costly drug injection of Wegovy or Ozempic? Kennedy and Oz, I predict, won't like the answer they get from those who don't want to be told what to do to live healthier or who try to change the content of what is on MAGA American menus. Remember what happened when Michelle Obama tried to push healthier eating as a first lady? Lots of pushback. You need to have trust to get people to follow your hard-to-take message to pursue self-denial for long-term rewards. Kennedy doesn't. Not as he babbles about the dangers of seed oils, which have done much to reduce heart disease. And Oz has a long, televised career of hawking wellness junk that he made money from. I doubt these are the guys to get America to make the changes that evidence-based wellness and prevention require and then stick with them. The biggest challenge, pushing prevention in a Congress full of red state legislators whose economies depend on growing corn for fructose and animals for breakfast and dinner, Kennedy and Oz don't stand a chance against this deeply entrenched crowd. Yes, we need to do more to prevent disease. We need providers to push us towards evidence-based wellness behaviors, and we need guides to get us on those paths. Kennedy, Oz, and their peers are the wrong choices in the wrong political environment to get us there. Now, this opinion piece only really alluded to the larger social determinants. Definitely the economic things that are going to get in the way is paramount, but changing the entire food system, for instance, is going to be a yeoman's task for sure. And this next article gets at that. This is from NBC News. RFK Jr.'s number one hurdle to take on unhealthy food? Money. The FDA's food division, poised to play a significant role in Kennedy's ambitions, operates on a tight budget. Unlike the agency's drug division, which sustains itself largely through user fees charged to pharmaceutical companies when they apply for drug approval, its food division relies more heavily on funding from Congress, said Gerald Mandy, a former FDA senior advisor and former deputy undersecretary for food safety at the Department of Agriculture. Separately, Kennedy has suggested he wants to end user fees, arguing the system creates a conflict of interest. Historically, Mandy said, Congress has been reluctant to provide money to the agency's food and nutrition program. The FDA's food program has a $1 billion budget, and only $25 million of that goes to food and nutrition and chronic disease, says Mandy, now an adjunct professor at Harvard University and the CEO of Nourish Science, a food advocacy group. So there's almost no money for it, and that is the number one barrier. They don't have the budget or staff to do anything. By comparison, the food industry spends almost $14 billion a year on advertising, the majority of which promotes fast food, sugary drinks, candy, and other unhealthy snacks, said Elisabetta Pilati, nutrition director at the Duke Diet and Fitness Center. The industry, she said, likely spends millions more on lobbying Congress. I think there is a striking comparison of how hard it is for consumers to make healthy choices when the food industry is so powerful. Kennedy's ideas about food are great, she said, but how you do that, I'm not so sure. Difficult, but not impossible. Marion Nestle, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University, said that even with limited funds, it's not impossible to take on the food industry, noting Kennedy isn't the only public figure who's tackled unhealthy foods. Former First Lady Michelle Obama, an advocate for healthy eating, started the Let's Move campaign, which focused on combating childhood obesity, including through healthy eating. She also championed the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010, which set new nutrition standards for school lunches, including more fruits and vegetables. Senator Bernie Sanders has called on more thorough reviews of food coming from abroad and recently compared the processed food industry to the tobacco industry. Mandy said the current FDA Commissioner Robert Califf has made food a priority during his second term. Califf led the restructuring of the FDA's food division in the wake of the 2022 infant formula shortage crisis, which arose after a facility was shut down due to bacterial contamination that the agency said might have been linked to two infant deaths. Still, it's apparent that the division moved slowly. Mandy said Califf has likely wanted to do more, but he's not been able to, quote, move through the bureaucracy to move on that or get the needed resources. I mean, everything RFK has been saying on chronic diseases and our food and the need to do something about it. Califf has been saying that, too, throughout his tenure, Mandy said. In July, the FDA finally banned brominated vegetable oil, a food additive primarily used in fruit-flavored sport drinks and sodas that carries potential health risks, including damage to the liver, heart, and brain. That ban, however, was only proposed last year, several decades after the agency concluded that its use in foods wasn't safe. The agency is also expected to propose new front-of-package nutrition labels in the coming weeks and is working on an update to the definition of healthy. although it's unclear if they'll be able to get that done before the new administration comes in. The FDA is also reassessing the potential cancer risk of red dye number 3, a synthetic food coloring that's already banned in California and Europe. In a statement, an FDA spokesman said the agency intends to make a determination on food red dye number 3 soon. Other additives in the U.S. that the U.S. allows but are banned in many European countries include yellow dyes number 5 and 6, and potassium bromate and azidocarbonamide, both used in flour to make bread. In need of allies. Of course, a lot of what Kennedy will be able to accomplish will depend on how he decides to shake up the public health agencies, including the FDA, Nestle said. Kennedy has threatened to eliminate entire departments at the agency, including the nutrition department. He'll need people with knowledge of how to move food policy forward. Mandy said Kennedy will likely need allies in the administration to accomplish his goals, particularly at the FDA and the Department of Agriculture, who can push Congress to do more. Trump hasn't yet announced the people he wants to fill those roles. To some degree, Kennedy may also work with the food industry. Nestle agreed, noting that the industry has remained mostly silent amid Trump's transition to the White House. They've been very, very quiet, and I don't hear the cereal companies making huge statements about the artificial colors, that there's no evidence that they're harmful, Nestle said. I don't hear the fast food industry saying anything, which is puzzling because those industries wasted not a millisecond when Michelle Obama tried to do something. It remains to be seen whether Kennedy will face pushback if and when he is confirmed. All experts agree that the best opportunity that Kennedy will have to make the most impact is the development of the 2025 Dietary Guidelines for America, which will provide nutrition guidance for the next 5 years, and the Department of Health and Human Services responsible for overseeing. The Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee is in the process of finalizing its scientific report, which will help inform the guidelines. Nestle said, however, she added, both HHS and USDA are responsible for setting the new guidelines. The agencies write the guidelines, and the agencies are going to have new secretaries, Nestle said. The dietary guidelines could very easily reflect Kennedy's agenda. Mandy said the dietary guidelines are a, quote, political process. As I mentioned, the budget they have to educate the public against food advertising, there is no budget, right? However, Kennedy will pretty much have the ability to write anything he wants in those guidelines, he said. It's powerful. So, of course, that's still advisory, and of course, most Americans don't follow the guidelines anyways, but they are an educational and certainly the bully pulpit of being the Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services could make some difference, one way or the other. And next up from the Food Politics blog from Marion Nestle, who's quoted in that last article, RFK Jr. to head HHS, brilliant move or catastrophe? I spent a lot of time last week responding to reporters' questions about Trump's appointing RFK Jr. to head the Department of Health and Human Services. In various statements, Mr. Kennedy has said he wants to get rid of, quote, poisons, such as ultra-processed foods in schools, artificial colors in cereals, chemicals, pollutants, pesticides, mercury in fish, fast food. He also wants to restrict sodas on the SNAP program, promote sustainable regenerative farming by small farmers, and conflicts of interest between government agencies and corporations, saying that corporate capture is the biggest threat to democracy. These are the kind of things I've been saying and write about for decades. He is also pushing for some things that are much less well-grounded in science, getting rid of grains for kids, seed oils, and fluoride in drinking water, deregulating raw milk, and firing all nutrition scientists on day one. If he really does do what he's promising here, it means taking on the food industry in a way that no government has ever done, and Trump showed no signs of doing in his first term. What can we expect? I have no idea, but this sure will be interesting to watch. Yeah, that's putting it mildly, I guess. I would also say that these wonderful things like promoting sustainable regenerative farming by small farmers, that, for instance, is something, like a lot of these things, that will actually fall under the USDA, not under the large umbrella of the Department of Health and Human Services. Okay, well, next up, I want to look at a more, quote, traditional way of dealing with some of these large problems. This is also from the Food Politics blog. UK House of Lords issues report on how to fix food systems. The House of Lords Food, Diet, and Obesity Committee has a lengthy 179-page new report, Recipe for Health, A Plan to Fix Our Broken Food System. Key finding, obesity and diet-related diseases are public health emergencies, costing society billions in healthcare costs and lost productivity. The key recommendation, the government should develop a comprehensive, integrated, long-term new strategy to fix our food system, underpinned by a new legislative framework. and a few of the selected key actions require large food businesses to report on the healthfulness of their products. Exclude businesses making unhealthful products from policy discussions on food, diet, and obesity prevention. Tax products high in salt and sugar, using revenues to make healthy food cheaper, and ban the advertising of less healthy foods across all media. So there you go, RFK Jr. You heard it here. Those are some things you can work on that would be helpful. Okay, well, next I would just like to do a long commentary and unpack some of that on RFK Jr. He's made a lot of crazy claims and has a lot of claims to fame. So let's just get on with this. First, he's a preeminent anti-vaxxer, perhaps the preeminent anti-vaxxer in America. There's been a lot of reporting. I won't spend a lot more time on that, but I would say that one of the longest running conspiracy theories he has is that vaccines cause autism. But I can tell you that families dealing with autism fear a backlash, discrimination and such, and a reversal of progress, being stuck back with things that people were dealing with 20, 30 years ago, rather than moving forward. And I would say, just in general, if you're not listening to the affected communities, you're probably off base and in trouble. Anti-fluoridation is another big thing. Fortunately, that's really more at the local level. The only thing I'll say is that there have been communities that have gotten rid of fluoridation, had seen a lot more cavities, and actually reinstituted. That's happened a couple of times. In larger communities where you can actually do that research, or where research is being done that would actually pick up that signal. He's also had a long track record of HIV/AIDS denialism, saying that that HIV is not even the cause of AIDS and such. And he's had racist ideas around that, as well as racist ideas around vaccines. He's been a major promoter of debunked treatments, most famously during COVID, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, which has had a lot of research, actually, and is not shown to be effective. One of his pet alternative therapies is chelating compounds. These are very much like, kind of more like, they're really shotgun kind of approaches, very crude, kind of more like bloodletting. Chelating compounds are things that grab certain mineral ions. They are not super specific, so when you throw them in your body, they start ripping a whole bunch of stuff out of your body, good and bad. And maybe as a last-ditch effort for somebody who has metal poisoning, well, for instance, RFK Jr. has mercury poisoning because he eats an unholy amount of tuna, and tuna has a lot of mercury in it. So maybe for him, chelating might be good, but as a broader treatment for many people, for many conditions, it's not been shown to be definitely not a first-line treatment. He's also, you know, talked about kind of the deregulating of psychedelics. I don't necessarily oppose that. I mean, the studies that have been done, they've really shown that where the benefits are is when it's embedded in other treatments, talk therapy, psychotherapy, counseling of various sorts, that type of thing. When you're doing that kind of thing, psychedelics can kind of facilitate that process. But just deregulating psychedelics or having them used kind of willy-nilly hasn't really shown to do much good, and can potentially cause a fair amount of harm. He talks about peptides. Peptides are actually, this is a whole range of different hormones, and these actually are sold often as dietary supplements. It's very, very unregulated, but I'm not sure that people should just be popping all kinds of hormones kind of willy-nilly without a good scientific basis for it. Vitamins, of course, everybody loves vitamins, but vitamins in a pill have been kind of a profoundly disappointing as far as being able to show, good health benefits. So it's better to get your vitamins from food, whole foods. He talks about clean foods, whatever clean is, but that can be, you know, getting out pesticides, mercury in fish, food dyes, ultra-processed foods, junk foods, sodas and sugar, that kind of thing. The pesticides thing, I think, is a real big one. Unfortunately, if he really wanted to deal with the pesticide things, he'd have to be in the EPA, which is not under Health and Human Services. But these other ones, you know, like some of those articles talked about, you know, he can go after, and good luck trying to change our food system. I wish him more power on that, but I'm afraid that it might be lost amid some of these other kind of strange eddies. One of those being raw milk, which has been shown to be very dangerous, does not have the purported, you know, great health benefits versus just regular milk. And particularly with bird flu going around and endemic around the country, in essence. In fact, they just found bird flu in raw milk in California. He talks about another thing called nutraceuticals, which I think are just fancy, high profitable, you know, plant compounds that are purported to have some benefits. Very little science showing that. He doesn't really talk about the more traditional kind of food as medicine. There's a lot of programs where, you know, you basically prescribe foods or give vouchers for fruits and vegetables, you know, this type of thing. It's probably a more sensible approach and better, you know, bang for your buck, so to speak. He really is one of these people that this danger of seed oils. And I think some of that is because some of the seed oils are GMO. But of course, the oil that you actually get basically contains infinitesimally small amounts of protein where any genetic material would be found, if that was your concern. And I don't think that concern is actually well-founded. And of course, but part of this is the whole argument of saying that oils, plant oils versus, like, you know, butter and lard and stuff is actually being better. I happen to disagree with that. I think saturated fats are pro-inflammatory, pro-cancer, a whole bunch of things. And in fact, seed oils, while I would say they're a highly processed food and you should minimize the amount that you have, I mean, eat nuts and avocados and things like that to get whole foods. But of course, you know, moderate amount of seed oils in your diet is not any great danger. And of course, he talks about, you know, I guess the government's effort to limit sunshine. I might agree with it. I think, you know, getting a little bit of sun is not bad for you. Skin cancer is the most common kind of cancer, but it's also one of the least dangerous of cancers, but it is very common and has caused a lot of problems with people. I would say, actually, most people are probably more concerned about it for, you know, aging their skin and such. And I can tell you, there's two things you can do if you want to age faster, particularly the way you look. Get a lot of sunshine without UV protection, or smoke, or both. Exercise, of course, you can't put that in a pill. So you need to exercise. I'm all for that. Exercise is a profoundly basic thing in a good life that promotes health. One thing that hasn't been much reported on, but is interesting, he made these remarks during a town hall past summer. This is one of his big ideas. I'm going to create these wellness farms where they can go to get off illegal drugs, off opiates, but also illegal drugs, other psychiatric drugs if they want to get off of SSRIs, which is the most common antidepressant, to get off benzos, to get off Adderall, and to spend time, as much as they need, 3 or 4 years if they need it, to learn to get reparented, to reconnect with communities. So this is a $1 trillion idea. I mean, if you were going to create these farms, particularly when you're talking about, depending how you cut this, you'd be offering that to, you know, 5, 10, 15, maybe close to 20% of the population. No, obviously most people wouldn't take you up on that. But if you were to actually offer that, you could easily be talking about a $1 trillion intervention, which would be like a quarter of all our healthcare. I kind of find a funny disconnect, an ironic disconnect, when he says to reconnect with communities. I'm not really sure how that would work when you send people off to these wellness farms. Is it going to be close enough to their home that they can maintain family life, community life, keep their job? I mean, it's kind of like particularly bizarre considering that Trump is talking about setting up kind of internment camps, which are entirely unhealthy. And then you would have this on the other side, these kind of wellness farms. Yeah, a little bizarre. I would say, why don't we provide housing to the homeless? And why don't we talk about the unwellness farms that we have in this country, which is in fact prisons and jails, which are filled with people who have addiction issues and mental health and or mental health problems. That is where the real dumping ground, which costs us a ton of money and is just making problems worse. So I don't know. I don't hear RFK Jr. talking about those things. I think fundamentally, he has a view that's more of a privileged upper class kind of this, you know, kind of freaky wellness attitude, rather than what I would see as the social Justice Foundation of Public Health, which talks about inequalities and understanding that health problems are concentrated in small groups of higher risk people, and that you need to deal directly with those, not just make the healthy people healthier and allow the sick people to get sicker. You cannot make America healthy doing that. I'm not sure when the time we would have considered that we were healthy. Overall, I mean, that's gone down certainly since 2015, if you're just looking at life expectancy. Well, another little Eddie in his term, should he be appointed, he is a longstanding supporter of abortion rights, and although he's been somewhat erratic on abortion during his campaign, he's shown a willingness to be malleable on that. That could be something that could create some problems within the administration. He also has kind of a law enforcement edge to himself. You know, he doesn't like mandates and stuff, but he has called to prosecute medical journals. So, and I think the law enforcement approach is basically the opposite of the public health approach. Other things is the FDA nominee, Dr. Makary, he wants to speed drug development, whereas RFK Jr. over the whole Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the FDA, wants actually to pause drug development. So that should be an interesting dynamic. In the end, I think one dynamic that's playing out here is that the Trump administration is a lot about demagoguery and winning the day with just, you know, public talk. And often they're better at talking than they are at doing. Look at the number of Fox News hosts that are going to be in appointed positions. And this is sort of as government as reality television. Now, how does, I'm going to coin a new term here, how does governtainment ultimately pan out? I'm not entirely sure. It's going to be a net negative, but it remains to be seen, and there are a lot of battles to be fought. But I think overall we're going to see a lot of deregulation on the health front, and we're going to see an overall weakening of evidence-based policies. There are a lot of half-truths out there masquerading as full truths, so beware, do not be fooled. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, last up in the regular reporting, I want to do a story on violence against women. Unfortunately, this election was the most gendered in presidential election in U.S. history, and I think the war on women and the war on women's health is well underway, and this story gets at some of that. And also, I would note that RFK Jr., for instance, as probably the health leader, if he gets the nomination goes through for Health and Human Services, I have heard very little about a global perspective. We live in a global environment, and this one health perspective that the earth and the ecology and human beings needs to be addressed in order for people to be healthy. But of course, over half of the people in the world are women, and this story gets at women and violence. This from The Guardian. Home is the most dangerous place for women, says Global Femicide Report. A report by UN Women found 85,000 women and girls are killed intentionally by men in 2023, and 60% of these deaths were committed by someone close to the victim. The organization said its figure shows that globally the most dangerous place for a woman to be was in her home, where the majority of women die at the hands of men. Naira Dzyaya Gumbanzavanda, and I apologize for all the times that I've massacred names on the show, but the UN Women's Deputy Executive Director said, what the data is telling us that it is the private and domestic sphere of women's lives where they should be the safest, but that so many of them are being exposed to deadly violence. We see the numbers in this report as the tip of the iceberg, she said, because we know not all women's deaths are recorded and not all causes of death are actually recorded as femicides. And there are many communities where we couldn't access any information. The UN Global Estimates on Femicide, defined as the gender-related killing of women and girls, showed an overall decrease on the 89,000 intentional deaths of women and girls in 2022, but an increase in numbers killed by intimate partners and family. So overall, numbers had gone down a bit, but we're seeing that's being more concentrated killed by intimate partners and family members. The report said that while men and women are victims of intimate partner or family violence, men account for 80% of all global homicide victims in 2023, but only 12% of these deaths were attributed to lethal violence within the family, compared with 60% of women. So a very different profile of the danger of violence for men and women. Women, it's in the home. Men, it's outside the home. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read to these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give a link again at the end of the list. A lot to get to with a record-tying 52 bonus articles. Number one, election grief is real. Here's how to cope. Understand the psychology of ambiguous loss can help. So obviously there's going to be a lot of loss immediately in the medium term and the long run. But it seems like America is going through this kind of grievance politics things where people have a lot of anxiety and alienation and don't exactly know what the responses are. And of course, we've reached out in desperation for Trump to save us. Yikes. I think that is diseased. Bonus article two, rates of anxiety, depression rising among Americans, especially the young. So that's been true for years. Let's get a little bit of good news, though, what things came out of the election with some of the state initiatives. Bonus article three, paid sick leave measures passed in Alaska, Missouri, and Nebraska. So this is a very important kind of social determinant and for the economic wellness of Americans. Bonus article four, Colorado became the second state in the country, next to California, to impose special taxes on guns and ammunition sales to fund social services. Bonus article 5. 7 of 10 states backed abortion rights, but little is to change yet. Of course, it takes a while, as we learned in Ohio. Even though you have a state constitutional amendment, it can take a year or more to really kind of work that through to make that a reality in any given state. Bonus article 6, a state-by-state breakdown of where abortion stands after the ballot initiatives pass, so a rundown of all 50 states. Bonus article 7, 10 reasons a second Trump presidency will decimate sexual and reproductive health. Yikes. Bonus article 8, abortion bans could reverse decades-long decline in teen births. A little ironic since conservatives, are trying to prevent teen births. But the abortion bans and the limits on reproductive health, contraceptions and the like, could result in actually, once again, teen births increasing. Bonus article 9, Trump likely to undo several of Biden's executive orders on health, such as restoring WHO membership and aiding reproductive health access, are likely to be reversed. So we'll probably get out of WHO membership again and reverse a whole bunch of reproductive health access executive orders. Bonus article 10, Trump selects corporate lobbyist Susie Wiles as chief of staff. Her lobbying firm has represented clients in the tobacco, junk food, insurance, and coal industries. Basically, a lot of these that we call commercial determinants of health. The worst of the worst. So, you know, if you think that somehow the Trump administration is going to break corporate hold on our politics and our life, I don't think so. Bonus Article 11. The FDA says it's winning the battle to cut farm antibiotics. The data tells a different story. So while there's some incremental wins on cutting farm antibiotics, the overall data is that it's not really getting any better. This just goes to show that even if you're trying to do regulations in a, quote, normal way, it's a lot of work and it's hard to do. But of course, if you're just coming across with a kind of a blanket deregulatory thing, that a lot of the stuff, these efforts are even going to be reversed, hard as they are to do, doing them right. And of course, this, I suppose, is a cautionary tale for those areas where they do want to clamp down on our regulations, that governing is actually hard. Talking about things, spouting off at the mouth is easy, but governing is hard. Bonus Article 12, new FDA rules for TV drug ads, simpler language and no distractions. So the Biden administration has been making a lot of incremental improvements and changes about TV drug ads. I'm actually with RFK Jr. on this one. He wants to get rid of them all. I think actually the incremental stuff, if you watch TV, commercial TV at all, you know that it's a mess. We are only one of two countries, us and New Zealand, that even allows drug ads directly to consumers. Get rid of them, please. Bonus Article 13. Millions at risk of losing health insurance after Trump's victory, as subsidies to buy insurance from the ACA marketplaces are set to expire at the end of 2025. This would be one of the biggest changes that could happen by doing nothing. These will expire unless they're renewed and could throw millions of people off health insurance altogether and will make health insurance a lot more expensive, either by having much higher premiums and or by having higher deductibles and copays, leading to economic insecurity that will ripple throughout America. Bonus Article 14, Trump tariffs could raise the cost of generic drugs in the U.S. A good example, of course, tariffs could raise the cost of everything that they slap a tariff on, but particularly generic drugs is one that's not particularly profitable. Most of the component parts come from overseas, so you may lose even what generic drug production there is in the U.S., not necessarily perhaps what Trump is actually trying to do, at least what he says he's trying to do. Bonus Article 15, TV's Dr. Oz is heavily invested in business regulated by the agency Trump wants him to lead. Conflicts of interest, never saw that before. Well, I think we'll see record levels in Trump 2.0. Bonus Article 16, Florida Governor DeSantis' Canadian drug import plan goes nowhere after FDA approval. I think this is actually a really good kind of model and example of, you know, a lot of talk and demagoguing on an issue, but when it comes down to actually governing and get the program up and running, it often doesn't happen. So they got a waiver to do Canadian drug importation, which is going to, you know, can lower the drug costs. It's been about a year and they haven't done anything to get it rolling. So a lot of talk, not necessarily a lot of results. Bonus Article 17, a new Trump administration will further loosen already lax rules on supplements. This is a case study in deregulating the unregulated. Supplements are very poorly regulated. And if regulation was the problem and getting all these wonderful supplements out there, the problem already would have been solved. Bonus Article 18, are food dyes bad for your health? The answer is probably yes. I think we should get rid of food dyes. Particularly, I have what you'd call a conservative precautionary principle that, you know, if in doubt, if something hasn't been proved safe, you shouldn't be sticking it in your body. And the fact that food dyes, the purpose they serve, it makes food look better, but I would put that on the lower end of a public health issue, is having your peas really, really green. If you want them really, really green, get them fresh, I guess, or frozen. Bonus Article 19, high consumption of ultra-processed foods linked to accelerated biological aging. And the interesting thing, the new thing this study contributed, is this is actually controlling for the traditional nutritional status. So it is all these ingredients that are used in ultra-processed foods that you would never use in your kitchen that are contributing to poor health, and in this case, accelerated biological aging. Bonus Article 20, food companies sell products that are less healthy in poor countries. So this is sort of makes me think of the tobacco companies when they were being regulated in this country. They just moved to other countries, poorer countries. And the fact that food companies are very powerful and they're multinational corporations. So if we are able to push back on a lot of these, some of that will be just inherited, and they're already promoting even less healthy foods in poorer countries than in wealthier countries. Bonus Article 21. USDA to eliminate school lunch electronic transfer fees for low-income families. So there's a lot of low-income families that have free meals, but they get like the money on a like a debit card or whatever, but they have to pay electronic transfer fees, which sometimes can be like a third of the cost of what the meal would have cost. This is really just the money changers getting in the way and getting a huge unjustified cut. End that. And so USDA is set to do that. Bonus Article 22. After Congress ended extra cash aid for families, communities tackle child poverty alone. So the pandemic child tax credit that was given proactively, monthly, to families, that ended. That cut child poverty in half. Now it's going back up when that expired. But there are some local communities that are trying to do that at least partially themselves. It has proven to be very effective in improving the wellness of young families. There is some bipartisan support, and hopefully we can see the child tax credit return in some form. Bonus Article 23, Trump is back. What could that mean for health policy? Exploring the powers and limits of the presidency. For the legal powers of the presidency, a good overview. 24, how RFK Jr.'s health proposals could stack up in practice. Again, another look in the real world. What does all his opinings, what possible courses could they take? Bonus Article 25, what to know about RFK Jr.'s stances on key health issues and what he could do at HHS. And this is, so one of these is from a lawyer, and the other ones are from program people who've actually done the job. Bonus Article 26, five of RFK Jr.'s most controversial views. You want to get a view on how each of those might play out. Good article. 27, I'm a vaccine activist, and I'm optimistic about the future right now. This is, there have been a lot of progress that's made in vaccine activism. There's been an unending stream of new vaccines that have been effective, and some very cost-effective, both on the global scale and here in this country. So I guess they're ready for a fight. Bonus Article 28. What's the status of the proposed ban on menthol cigarettes? So, after all is said and done, cigarettes is still the single largest preventable cause of death. The Biden administration has punted on the ban on menthol cigarettes several times. It's possible that they could get it done before Trump's in office, but actually don't know what Trump would do with that. But it's a very important thing, as tobacco is still a major killer. Bonus Article 29. After a youth vaping surge, the UK moves to ban disposable e-cigarettes. Most of the e-cigarettes that are sold in the U.S. are actually illegal. So I guess they're banned, but it's not enforced. So, you know, that's just the way it is. But UK is actually trying to create a tobacco-free generation. This is one of the fronts they're fighting with. Bonus Article 30. Turning lawns into microfarms helps LA families conserve water and grow fresh food. The interesting thing here is it actually takes less water to grow fresh food in your front yard than it is to just have grass there. So, hey, this is another example of an alternative world we can live in. But back to the real world, 31, retailers fail to replace hazardous packaging, report finds. So very, very slow on the retail front to get rid of hazardous packaging, a lot of the plastic and plastic chemicals that are inundating us. Bonus Article 32, rainwater sample reveals it's literally raining forever chemicals in Miami. I've reported this from different communities across the country. It is true. What this research adds is it looks like that actually dust, when you get very much drying, the dust throws up these forever chemicals, and then that dust and the water combine air, you know, many, many states away or even around the world. So, bikes, our world is changing, which leads us to Bonus Article 33. Plastic pollution is changing entire Earth system, affecting the climate, biodiversity, ecosystems, ocean acidification, and human health. We're plasticizing the world. Bonus Article 34. Microplastics in wastewater are shielding pathogens from being destroyed by treatment. So these pathogens stick to the microplastics and are able to ride through the treatment process without being destroyed. Yikes. Bonus Article 35. Garbage dumps may produce the next pandemic. This is just another place where garbage, waste, including human or animal waste, and animals get together. So it's a good place for a crucible mixing a potential next pandemic. Bonus Article 36. Bird flu virus in Canadian teenager displays mutations demonstrating virus's risk, where they had mutations that could increase the transmissibility among humans. Kind of a proof of concept. That's scary. Bonus Article 37. CDC calls for expanding testing for bird flu after seroprevalence blood tests reveal more farm worker infections. So before, the seroprevalence means you just test a whole subset of the population to see how much of the antibodies are actually there. People have actually been infected with bird flu rather than just clinically waiting for somebody to have symptoms and test them. When they did this, they found a scary level of people that actually had bird flu way, way more than what they were finding just by testing kind of as symptomatic people showed up. And bonus Article 38, could avian flu cause our next pandemic? Of course, the answer is yes, it's something we need to be worried about. But if you want a good overview of that, here's a good article. Bonus Article 39, invest in triple rapid test to fight Mpox, H5N1 bird flu, and beyond. This is just asking to do more research and development into these quick testing that can be easily deployed, and you get, like, you know, results in a minute, so that we can do better surveillance, and you can actually do it at home, you know, if you're at risk or have symptoms of any of a number of diseases. Bonus Article 40. Global antibiotic consumption has increased substantially since 2016. So this has been something that is a continuing problem. There's been efforts to try to reduce antibiotic consumption, but in fact, it's going up. Similar to climate change. We know what we need to do, but we're going the opposite direction. Bonus Article 41. Real-world data on the RSV vaccine for older adults shows high effectiveness. Sometimes the clinical trials data is different than the real-world data, but here they're both showing high effectiveness. Bonus Article 42. CDC data shows U.S. diabetes rate rises to nearly 1 in 6 adults. Yikes. Well, we definitely have a chronic disease problem. Next article gets to that as well. 43, chronic pain affects 1 in 4 Americans, with nearly 9% having pain severe enough to restrict daily activities. 44, national survey shows almost half of Americans are hurt by others' drinking and drug use. Very widespread. Bonus Article 45, the recovery community says it offers refuge from opioid addiction, but it's still hostile to life-saving addiction medications. Bonus Article 46, Governor DeWine announces recommendations to create space at near-capacity state psychiatric hospitals that are filled by the criminal justice system. So there's a lot of kind of incremental, small little things that you can do to try to free up a little more space. But this is truly an example of the tail wagging the dog. This is because the criminal justice system is flooding the state psychiatric hospitals with people that need evaluations for competency to trial, or if they're convicted, and, you know, the insanity pleas, all this kind of stuff. That fills up basically the entire state psychiatric hospitals. We need to reform our criminal justice system. We need to treat people for addiction and mental health issues so that they don't get dumped in an expensive and unwell criminal justice system. Bonus Article 47, how United Health's playbook for limiting mental health coverage puts countless Americans' treatments at risk. So United Health is one of the biggest health insurers in the country, and it is doing whatever it can to limit mental health coverage so that it can make more money. Not good in the private sector. 48, as nuns disappear, many Catholic hospitals look more like megacorporations. So this is just the morphing of all the, you know, profit, nonprofit divisions, you know, that is basically just looking more and more like megacorporations all over. Of course, you'd kind of expect that direction if it's all about the money. Bonus Article 49, ambulance hits Oregon cyclist, then charges him nearly $2,000 for a ride to the hospital. Couldn't resist that. Crazy. Bonus Article 50, after Trump's victory, the South Korean 4B movement is spreading across TikTok, calling on women to not date, marry, sleep with, or have children with men. So if you're familiar with the Greek tragedy, or Greek play, comedy and tragedy, I suppose, of Lysistrata, where during the Peloponnesian War, women refused to have sex with their husbands until they stopped the war. This is a version of that, of a movement that's taken off in South Korea and is spreading across TikTok in America. Look out. Bonus Article 51. Adequate sleep is essential to better decision making. Going back to a pillar of health, we definitely need sleep in order to have a good, healthy life. And if you want to make better decision making, and we have plenty of decisions to make in our personal lives and nationally, let's get some sleep. Bonus Article 52, last but not least, are schools with armed police actually safer? New research casts doubt on the benefits of deploying officers in public schools to deter criminal activity. And I'd just like to end with that reminder that public health and law enforcement worldviews are pretty much opposite. And the idea that you can force safety through arms, democracy through arms, however far you want to carry it, is very, very different than the underlying philosophy that undergirds the professional science of epidemiology, which is that there's inequalities in distributions of all kinds of social determinants for health, that it's concentrated in small populations, and that you actually need justice, these inequities, to be addressed in order for the entire population to be whole. We need to deal with the weakest links, and cannot just hog it up for ourselves thinking that somehow that'll be a net good. We have a shared fate. You can read any of these 52 bonus articles and ones from earlier shows by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice. There are a lot of half-truths out there masquerading as full-truths, so beware. Do not be fooled.